Do not buy real estate, if you can afford it, based on interest rates. You can only lock in that price of that home one time, but you can keep redoing your loan and ride interest rates down. The smart people buy homes when no one else is.
Today's episode of Real Talks on the Rocks is with Scott Hill of Scott Hill Mortgages. So Scott goes very much in detail about realistic expectations of what you need to have and what you should think about when it comes time to purchasing a home.
I see clients that have really great income and they've got massive debt. They just earn a lot of money. Doesn't mean they handle their finances well. The biggest thing you can do in leading up to buying a house and able to talk about is get yourself out of debt if you can. And if they had just waited on the car, they might have afforded another $100,000 in buying power and then get the car, because it's easy to get a car.
Got it.
Not easy to get a house.
So let's talk mortgages, Scott. So for the person who doesn't understand how this whole process works when you buy a house, where does this whole thing start off when you find a realtor, you find the house that you want, you said, I want to go forward with it. And this is where you come in, correct?
Sure.
So how does this process work?
You know, it's basically where it often works for me. Being a loan officer doing this 27 years, you know, a lot of our business is going to be working with home buyers and also with people that already are home buyers and need to refinance their loan. But when they're starting out as a home buyer, often where the introduction takes place is usually from a real estate agent. That's where most of our clients actually come from. They get referred into us and, you know, a lot of them have no idea. They don't know what they don't know. And so it's a matter of kind of walking them through steps, asking them what's important to them. You know, what do you think is going to be affordable to you on a budget? Where do you want to live? What kind of property would you like? We discuss all those things. And then we just get into really simple math. How much are you earning? How much debt are you carrying? How much house do you think you'd like to buy? And then we reverse engineer off of how much cash they have and figure out the loan size they should be taking on. And then factor in other things like, is it a condo where there might be HOA dues, factor in their property taxes and insurance, and then of course the mortgage itself. And then we just work through the numbers to make sure it's going to be comfortable for them. But traditionally it starts from a referral typically coming in, and it's usually real estate agents. Why? Because most buyers go directly to the realtor. They don't usually call up a lender first.
Well, that may make sense. Now, do most buyers come to you with the mindset of, tell me what I can afford, or do they go and say, you know, I found the house of my dreams over here in whatever, San Francisco, get me in that house?
Great question. You get all kinds. You get some buyers that they've spent the last 6 months on the internet trying to figure things out for themselves, and they got a decent handle on what they think their budget is. So we'll go from that all the way to, I have no clue, Scott. I don't know where to begin. And I like that process of working with that person that doesn't have a clue, because it's fun to take them from they know nothing to where they feel really confident and got it all figured out. Hey, I can do this. I just had a wonderful gal today. It's funny you mentioned that. She didn't know what she didn't know. She was a parole officer, and she just came into my office this morning, as a matter of fact, wonderful gal, to sign her papers. She knew nothing. Was scared to death of the whole process. She signed papers today, and you should have seen the smile on her face, you know, knowing that she was able to do this. We took her from knowing nothing to, you can do it. And she's going to be a homeowner in less than a week now.
Wow.
And she says she didn't think she could afford a home as a single gal, and it was a little emotional even for me just to see her so nervous and kind of getting tears in her eyes. It was pretty awesome. So we see the whole gamut. Know nothing to, you know, pretty confident that they've got this figured out already, and I've got the money, I've got the income. I need you, Scott, to help, but we kind of think we know everything.
Yeah,
it's not as fun working with someone like that. I love the ones that just the appreciation's there, and you know, I'm kind of like their Sherpa, leading them up to the base camp 1, 2, and 3, and then we eventually hit that summit, up on Mount Everest. That's I enjoy that process a lot.
So how does that work with the income and how much people, because, you know, the traditional mindset was you want to buy a home or property, you got to have 20% down or whatever that cost is. And then you would go based off of your income and say, I could afford X amount of mortgage per year.
Yeah.
And then you go off of that. But then we all should understand that even with the mortgage, there's still other costs associated with that house.
Yeah.
Maintenance, insurances, property taxes, the whole gamut. How does that conversation start with somebody from the very beginning with, okay, you're bringing this to the table now. If we work with this, here's what you can do, or if you want to get over here, this is what we need to work on?
Sure. No, that's a great question. And that's kind of what I love about my job, in a sense, is that every individual is kind of like a puzzle, and we got to put all the pieces together, right? And so it often just starts out kind of like I mentioned before, where they have an idea in their mind where they want to live and maybe that neighborhood, and they just don't know what it's going to take to get there. So I need to uncover, you know, what it's going to be to make that work. It's X plus Y equals Z, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and so what is their income? What are their debts? We're going to figure out what Z is going to be. And so we start out with determining, are they self-employed? Do they write off a lot on their property? On their income taxes, mm-hmm. you know, because a lot of times they report to the IRS less than they're actually bringing in revenue every month. And they, in their mind, think, oh, I'm probably going to qualify for this. And, well, you're self-employed. What you tell the IRS is what lenders are going to use. Mm-hmm. So if you write off a lot, it's going to lessen your buying power. But your W-2 person, your salaried person, pretty easy to determine their income. Once we get their income, you know, we want to kind of review their debt, figure out what are their monthly payments. Now, the things that get counted into how much you qualify for a mortgage is going to be what shows up on your credit report. So you don't got to worry about, you know, things, you know, little things that wouldn't show up on your credit report. We don't count that. In fact, we go off of gross income. Mm-hmm. A lot of times buyers come in thinking, oh, it's my net take home. I only take home this. That's what's going to get used. No, it's off of gross. So we're going to look at your annual income. So let's make it monthly. Let's say, for instance, someone makes, you know, $120,000 a year. That's $10,000 a month, right? And let's say their mortgage is, and taxes and insurance and everything is, you know, say $4,000, okay? And then let's say they've got a car payment for $500 a month. So now we're up to $4,500. And let's say they've got credit cards adding up to $500. Now we're at $5,000 debt heading out of their pocket every month. Well, what's coming in? $10,000. So you simply divide the big number and the little number. That's a 50% DTI, or debt to income ratio. That would be considered too high. Okay. Mm-hmm. Comfort, really, back in the old days, was the housing expense only, not even counting debt, 28% of your gross income. Okay. So that would be $2,800 payment on a $10,000 income, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, we know that's not realistic. We said we're talking Bay Area, so yeah, that exactly. Number's got to go up. So I find often a lot of my clients are having to get, with their debt combined, all added in there, often, more often than not, they're in the low 40s.
Hmm.
All right, and even a lot of jumbo loans, you know, there's limitations to about 43%, sometimes 40% debt to income ratio. So it's kind of like a pilot flying a plane in bad weather. You're trusting your instruments, right? Hey, I'm level, you know, or I'm ascending or descending. Same thing with buying a house is we want to know what's comfortable. Mm-hmm. I've never had a client in with those ratios that I just laid out to you call me later and say, I'm struggling, I can't make it work. Mm-hmm. So we've grown, right, from 28 to the 30s, and now we're often in the 40s. It'd be great to stay in the 30s. It's just not possible a lot of times for a lot of people in the Bay Area. But that's what we're looking at. So I kind of explain it to them like that, and I let them know, social proof, right? Many, many other clients are comfortable in this range, and you're going to be also.
Mm-hmm.
But the biggest thing you can do in leading up to buying a house, and maybe we'll talk about it, is get yourself out of debt if you can. You know, oftentimes clients come to me a month, 2 months too late. They just bought a car. Mm-hmm. And if they had just waited on the car, they might have afforded another $100,000 in buying power. And then get the car, because it's easy to get a car.
Got it.
It's not easy to get a house.
Well, let's talk about this debt to income ratio, because it's a big one. And yeah. Most people are embarrassed to talk about any debts that they actually have.
Yeah.
You know, I remember those days when I had tens of thousands of dollars in credit card debt because I didn't know how to manage money in my early 20s. And mm-hmm. It was something you just didn't talk about, because it's almost an admittance that I screwed up somewhere and I don't want to tell people that. I have to work to get it out on my own.
Mm-hmm.
So what are some of the typical debts that people are bringing in to these conversations? Is it just car loans? Or how big are student loans into this whole thing? What are some of the things you're seeing that people hear right now? I need to make sure I work on this. And then also, how do you account for debts that they don't have now, but also they might have in the future? Maybe they will need a car in 5 years, things like that.
Great question. That second part, if I forget to answer it, remind me on that. But the most common debt I'm seeing is credit card debt. All right. And that's partially because where the economy is right now, and people are having to leverage their lifestyle in a lot of instances. I also see car loans. Like I said earlier, you know, you're buying a car at the wrong time. They should be buying it, hopefully, after they get the house, right?
Right.
And then we see a lot of student loans because people are funding their way through college. And, you know, oftentimes it's they don't really necessarily want to pay those off because they're low interest rates, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we do got to factor that debt in anyway. So the credit cards is often also one of the first things I try to eliminate, especially if a buyer is down the line. They know they're 6 months out to a year.
Mm-hmm.
Because carrying credit card debt with high balances compared to the limit the credit card company is offering you, that affects your score.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have a lower credit score, you're going to pay more for your mortgage, which adds to your expense, which increases your debt-to-income ratio. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So if we can eliminate credit card debt, phenomenal. It also helps with their scores as well. Car loans is a little bit tougher if they don't have a large down payment. We can't use a lot of those funds to, you know, to pay off the car, and it can affect their buying power. Sometimes we'll have them sell their car.
I mean, the way it works.
And, you know, there's creative ways where someone you know might be able to buy your car or what have you. And so at least we can eliminate that payment and maybe, you know, they can buy that car back again down the road or something like that. But those are the big ones that really hold someone back as far as their buying power.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What was the second part of the question you had?
Accounting for future debts.
Oh yeah,
that
future
they're
debts.
Have.
So that's where the debt to income ratio conversation comes in, and it leads me to budgeting, a conversation that I often have with clients. And you know, I was just talking with someone earlier today. It's really a shame that we don't get taught a lot of this financial IQ stuff in school.
Yeah.
And I talked at yesterday at a veterans event, and I was talking to some of the young students in there. I was letting them know the four basic steps to wealth. There's six or seven, but you got to focus at least on the first four. Number one, you got to run a budget. That's why most businesses fail. It's financial issues, right? You're not tracking what's coming in and what's going out. So if you write it down, you see it in front of you, it hits you right in the forehead. This is my debt. I don't have much left over. How much of this money am I spending is really wasteful, and it's needs versus wants is what you got to look at. So you need to know what's coming in. All right, now what's left over? Once you figure that out, you're on a good starting point. Now what your bills are is what I call your survival number. You got to pay that whether you have a job or you don't have a job. So you need to know your survival number. And I'm talking everything. What does haircuts cost? I get my haircut six times a year. Great. You know, multiply that out to what it should be for monthly, right? Add that column. All your debts, whatever they are. Expense for your pets, whatever. Figure that out. Now we know our survival number. Step two, eliminate all consumer debt. Not mortgage. Mortgage is a good debt. It's buying an asset, goes up in value, gives you tax deductions, helps get you wealthy. It's leverage. It's a great, great asset or debt to have. Eliminate consumer debt. Number three, build up 3 minimum months in reserve of what that survival number was. So if your survival number is $5,000 to live, I want to see $15,000 over in a money market account, somewhere safe that you're not going to dip into. That is your emergency fund. So that if tragedy strikes, you lose your job, get hit with a big emergency bill on the car, you got your emergency fund to pay for it, so you don't got to go into debt on credit cards. Now you spend the next few months building back that emergency fund. I prefer 6 months, but at least three.
Mm-hmm.
And then number four, notice I haven't mentioned retirement yet. Why would we be pumping money into our retirement, earning 6%, 7%, 8%, when we're spending 28% on a credit card? Doesn't make sense, does it?
Mm-hmm.
So you wait. Now you laid the foundation. You got the sticks going up like you're building a house, right? We're ready to stucco. Now we're going to put the roof on. Now I'm going to fully fund my retirement account. Max it. Take advantage of matching whatever you can get. That foundation right there started young, right? In mm-hmm. your youth, when you start working, it's going to set you up for massive wealth when you're older.
Gotcha.
Okay. So to answer your question, I kind of talked to him about what are the expenses that are going to come when we become a homeowner. Oh, you're going to have that nice big driveway, so you got to get a nice fat car for that driveway, right?
Yeah.
You know, you're furniture. We got to go nuts on furniture now, right? No, we got to be realistic. That's why, especially when I know someone is scraping together a bare minimum down payment, and I know that their income to debt ratios might be high, we really need to have that conversation about those debts that are going to be coming and making sure we resist them. Because the best thing that we did with the funds that they did have was get them into a house and become a homeowner. But let's watch the spending afterwards.
Gotcha. So let's talk some, I'll give you two examples here so people can understand of the same person, how the difference has changed. Let's say you have somebody, and we'll use Bay Area salaries because this is more for Bay Area, this is more of a Bay Area audience. Yeah. Let's take, what would you say an average household income here in the Bay Area is? 100,000, 80,000, 150,000?
Yeah, 120 something, 130, somewhere in that range, probably on average.
So let's say 100,000, we'll just pick that number there.
Make it easy.
Household income making $100,000 a year, we live in the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. On one side, you have someone that's done everything that you said. We have zero consumer debt. Our cars are paid off. We have our 6-month reserve in our high yield savings account, money mm-hmm. market account, whatever. And we have, let's say, 50 grand separate aside we want to put towards a house. Mm-hmm. Then you have somebody on the other side, $100,000 income or household income. Then maybe they have 20 grand in credit card debt. They have little to no savings. And they have the same 50 grand that they saved down payment. In the retirement account, this guy over here is maximizing it, that person isn't. How big is the difference in buying power for those two people with the same income, but obviously different levels of debt and personal savings? Like, what could each one realistically afford, and how much more is this person with the debt going to be paying roughly, because they might have to take a higher interest loan?
Well, yeah, I mean, it really depends. I used to, 10, 15 years ago, I kind of had a rule of thumb that you would, if you had no debt at all, take your income and multiply it times 3 to 5. Somewhere in there is about the size loan you could handle. The rest needs to be made up with a down payment.
Okay.
But that will fluctuate based on what the interest rate is that you're paying. So that's why I say somewhere between 3 to 5, right? So, I have to have some tough conversations with some buyers where sometimes we'll say, you know what? You want to be a homeowner. I want you to be a homeowner. The time's not right now for you to be a homeowner. Let's focus on getting rid of this debt. Because if you try to buy with this much debt, you're going to have buyer's remorse. You're going to be struggling. You're going to be stressed out. And there's a chance that, you know, you're going to accumulate a lot of credit card debt and put at risk being a homeowner and making that payment. So it's really, every situation is going to be unique. When I look at someone, I always look at how much cash do you have? What is your spending habits look like, right? You get financially naked when you sit down with me. So I'm going to see, right? You pay your bills on time or you don't. You accumulate a lot of credit card debt. I see all kinds of stuff. I see clients that have really great income and they've got massive debt. Now you would think they got great income, they probably handle their finances really well. No, they just earn a lot of money.
Yep.
Doesn't mean they handle their finances well. And so I want to make sure I don't put them in a high debt to income ratio situation, because they have the propensity to carry a lot of debt. So that's a whole different conversation. Then I'll get someone over here that says, you know, or I look at their profile and it's like, they don't really have a whole lot of debt at all. They're pretty good earners. They're really financially savvy. I feel comfortable pushing them, or not pushing them, but allowing them, as long as they're comfortable, to go to that much higher debt to income ratio, because I see how they handle their finances and they're not at risk of getting themselves into a lot of trouble with future consumer debt.
Mm-hmm.
So every situation is going to be kind of unique, but it's kind of just stepping back and looking at what I call their profile, their financial profile.
Got it.
And then explaining that to them and see how they, you know, oftentimes they agree. They go, yeah, you're right. You know, and then we figure out, all right, this is the debt to income ratio we should look at. Now there's different ways to get to that debt to income ratio.
Yeah.
More down payment, buy less an expensive home. You know, and there's some clients too, where it's like, hey, you know, I get a big bonus at the end of the year. I can push it a little bit. I know I got this debt, but I'm going to wipe that debt out down the road. It's okay. Well, then I'll allow you to go a little higher on your debt to income ratio. Hmm. And but here's what you need to do. You know, wipe out that debt.
Yeah.
Are we in agreement? I want buy-in from them, right? Cause they're the ones that got to make the payment, but I got to shed light on the whole picture so that they're comfortable with the path of what we're discussing, you know.
You mentioned something there that I know people do. And I don't know if this is a good thing or a bad thing, but the whole idea of, I know I'm going to get that bonus, or I'll just work more overtime if you're in public safety. That can be very dangerous for some people, because now you're dependent upon that. And if something happens,
that's true.
The company didn't make the numbers. You don't get that bonus the year that you thought you were, or, you know, all the overtime dried up. There's no money more to pay for that. And you have to rely on your basic income. So I know people are going to try to stretch out the number when they can fudge it and say, there's ways I can make more this month or every month. But then do you go back and say, that's great if you do, but let's talk about what you're guaranteed to make, what's your base salary. Like if you went out on disability for a year for some reason, that this is what you're going to bring in. Are those conversations tough to have with people who may account for that?
No, that's great. I'm glad you brought that up. So buying a house is emotional, right, for people. They're oftentimes they get blinded by just they're envisioning, you know, backyard pool parties and I'll just whatever it takes to get this house, I'm there. And you got to pull the reins in on them a little bit if they, you know, their financial situation looks like they're going to be big spenders or whatever and say, well, let's talk about this and slow down a little bit here. But I often, just the other day, I had a couple weeks ago, a client, I was doing my pre-qual analysis with them, my first meeting and going through a conversation about what we should be looking at for a home for them. And they protected themselves by saying, you know, my wife is going to be working here pretty soon. She's going to make this, but I want to qualify just off of me, as if that income she's going to get isn't even going to count. That way I know I feel comfortable. Right. And so they're actually building in their own protection and they're saying, we're going to be real conservative with this. Others are like, they're trying to count every little dollar they got. Yeah. I can go work overtime. I can go do this and that. Hey man, we know life.
Yeah.
It's not always going to happen. Mm-hmm. You know, don't count on it, especially if we're pushing those ratios. Right.
Yeah.
But this is why I talked to him about, it's so important to think about reserves. Cause the, you know, one of the problems is with a lot of mortgages is, you know, your VA loans, which are phenomenal, your FHA loans, and even most conventional loans, you don't have to have a lot of reserves. As long as you have the down payment and closing costs, you're in. And so they're not even forcing you to have reserves like the jumbo loans do. So that's why I like to have that conversation with clients about, I really don't want us to use all our money. And oftentimes one of the things I'll do is I'll say, hey, listen, let's see if we can talk to the seller about getting some seller credit to cover some of your closing costs so that that money you earmarked for closing costs that was now going to wipe you out when you added it to your down payment, now you get to keep some of that in your pocket and start some reserves when we get into that home. And so that's a great tactic to utilize to help keep some more money in their pocket. Because I don't like seeing clients wipe out all their money knowing they're instantly going paycheck to paycheck after that to keep this thing afloat.
Got it. What are your thoughts on the generic mortgage calculators? Do they work? Do they give you a good idea? Or really, they don't account for so many other factors?
Great question. Most of them don't account for all the other factors. And the biggest problem with them, it's a great place to start if you're really generic. Hey, I got no debt and I got a salary. All right, that's going to work for somebody to kind of get an idea. But even then, most of them don't calculate property taxes correct. You don't know what your insurance is going to be. You don't know how your income is going to be looked at by a lender, you know? One of the big problems that a lot of clients have when they get on those calculators, especially in the Bay Area, you got RSU income, you got a lot of bonus income, you got a lot of, you know, nurses and teachers and, you know, where there's overtime, police officers, you know, first, there's overtime, things of that nature. How does my income get calculated? Mm-hmm. You know? And a lot of times what they don't realize is that when you start with a new employer, you need to go for 24 months before we can count that overtime, that bonus, because that has to get averaged over 24 months. So they make the mistake. They go take a new job. They get a little lower salary, but they said, wow, I'm going to get so much more bonus here though. Mm-hmm. Well, we're not counting any of that bonus until you're there for 2 years. I wish I'd gotten to you before you quit your job, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, so when they go online on the calculators, they don't know what input to put in, what data to input. And so it's the garbage in, garbage out thing. It's a tool to use. But really what you want to do is talk to a lending professional because we can figure out a rough back of the napkin sketch 2-3 minutes on UTI, right? Which is different than pre-approval. That's the official turn everything in. But a pre-qual can do that pretty quickly. So the calculator is a great place to start, but you might not get the numbers that you really need to know.
Do they tend to overestimate or underestimate?
They overestimate their income.
Over, okay.
And they
I mean the calculators themselves.
Oh, the calculators are going to be accurate. If you say I make 100,000, my rate is 6.5, and I'm taking a 30-year, and I got no debt, you know, it's probably going to be fairly accurate in that sense.
Gotcha.
But they, you know, they forget things like maybe I'm going to have HOA dues, or, you know, I'm in a foresty area where, you know, getting hazard insurance is going to be a lot more expensive due to fire hazard and things of that nature. But I think it's a great place to start when you're just trying to, you know, get an idea. But nothing beats, you know, talking to a loan professional.
What, I mean, we're kind of jumping over the place, which
That's all right.
Good, because this is a lot of good stuff that you bring out to me.
Yeah.
You mentioned something earlier that I wanted to get to, which is something that you hear in the media a lot, mm-hmm. buyer's remorse. Mm. What do you think, from what you've seen, causes a lot of buyer's remorse, specifically in the Bay Area? Is it they're in over their heads with what they thought they can afford? Is it that, you know, they told me that I could do it and I didn't realize, oh, it was going to be this on the back, and maybe repairs were way more than they thought because they got the house that was a little cheaper, but it needed a whole bunch more work. Is it things that maybe tie into the relationship between, I'm assuming these are the, sure. there's a married couples and they realize, oh, this is, we didn't see that, you know, this whole part coming here. What are some things that you've seen with that?
You know, honestly, I don't see a lot of buyer's remorse. Maybe that's just me, but because they're just so ecstatic that they got into the Bay Area housing
true
market. That. It's never, hey, I got in over my head. I never hear that. And maybe that's because the kind of conversations that I have with clients that make sure that they realize they're not getting in over their head. I'm not going to let them. Sometimes it's I didn't really research the area well enough. It's really not the neighborhood that I... If I had taken more time, I might have wanted to be, you know, over here instead of over here. It's really never been an affordability thing. I've never had a client call me and say, my gosh, I've got in over my head. I can't afford this. I shouldn't have done it. Mm-hmm. Never do I get that. So I don't get a whole lot of buyer's remorse. Sometimes I'll hear, gosh, I wish I had done this 2 years earlier. Mm-hmm. That's the remorse they usually have, is I should have done it earlier because I would have had X amount more equity in a home. I would have had a couple more years of paying down a mortgage, because that's what a mortgage is, forced savings. Mm-hmm. You're knocking principal down every month. So it's a two-way street here. We got principal going down and home values going up. And in between is ours, right? And they missed out on that. They missed out on the tax breaks. And the longer you wait to buy, property taxes are going to be higher too. People forget that.
Oh, yeah. Those, Uncle Sam will get you every mm-hmm. which way.
Yeah.
How about issues such as, you know, I knew I was living close to an airport, but I'm sure to be fine, not realizing, oh, the planes that are coming in at 5 a.m. are going to wake me up. Or I bought this house. I know it needs some work, but it should be manageable. And then you get there and realize, oh, for what I want, it needs a lot more work. How about issues like that?
Not a lot. I think most of the real estate agents that I'm blessed to work with do a really good job of explaining to their clients before they put their signature on an offer what they're getting into. They're really going through the inspection report. They're getting data for the client on neighborhood. What's the school like? Because that's the big thing for buyers now. Mm-hmm. It has been for years. What school district am I in mm-hmm. to hold home values and that kind of thing? As far as maintenance, a lot of times I'll have clients come to me and go, Scott, we know that homes are so expensive. We're looking for what we call a fixer-upper. And I say, okay, there's a difference between a fixer-upper and a property that's got a lot of problems, because we're not going to be able to finance it if it's got a lot of problems. But if it's TLC stuff, fixer-upper, no problem. And they'll say, we're going to do sweat equity. So we're going to buy that home a couple $100,000 cheaper and take our time and put money into it and build it up and get it to how we want it to be, which is going to also bring in more value with that home over time, make it more desirable. So it's a great question. I wish I could say, yeah, hey, I got all these stories of people that have remorse, but I just don't get them.
Well, it's good that you don't have the stories. That means you're doing something right with that. Yeah. Like, how about in general, though, when you've seen, like, because that's what people hear in the news. You'll hear when the mortgage rates are going higher, then people, the things that make the headlines in the newspaper are, you know, millennials are having buyer's remorse because they didn't realize that now they're going to have to pay this much money and then the costs are going up and they didn't know. And maybe that's just related to they got bad information when they signed up. Or was it more blind faith? Like, I just want to do it, press the button, and then hopefully everything works out. Even if my advisors told me, you're pushing it, you can do it, but, you know, really think about it. Are you sure you want to do this? And they say, yep, I need a house because that's how I generate income. Not realizing, oh, well, this particular deal that I took probably wasn't the best financial move. Maybe that's just because that's what you hear more in the media.
Well, I think so, right? What's the term? If it bleeds, it leads, all that kind of stuff, right? You know, there are those stories, though, because let's face it, you know, no matter what industry you're in, there's bad people in that industry that are lazy and don't do their job mm-hmm. and just collect a paycheck. And then there's those that go above and beyond and say, I'm here to look out for you. I'm the one that's trained in this. I'm here to guide and protect you. And so there are people out there that that even do what I do that really they're order takers. They're not professionals. They're amateurs. They're just there to, hey, I got to get an approval and get a commission check. And to me, that's just abhorrent. They need to get out of the industry, you know? And so you're going to get people that don't have these conversations that we've talked about here today. And then they're not prepared because they're not thinking through, because it's our job to help them see what they can't see.
Mm-hmm.
We, you know, we've done this thousands of times. We know there's only so many bad things that can happen. And there's a few things we can do to make sure those don't happen. But some people don't take the time to educate themselves. It's not their fault. They just don't know what they don't know. They let emotion run too quickly. They don't vet out their real estate agent. They don't vet out their loan officer. You know, I'll get clients that call me up and what's your rate? I say, hold on a minute. Have you thought about the other, you know, 5 to 10 things you should be asking the person that's about to help you with the biggest financial investment of your life? You know, what do their reviews look like? You know, how long have they been doing this? You know, how many transactions roughly do they do per year? You know, what's your communication level going to be like? What's your availability going to be like? Are you going to play a part when I go to write an offer? Or are you just going to sit back and wait to hear them in contract? Or are you going to call on my behalf to every listing agent when I write an offer? Talking about how wonderful these clients are and what the communication with the loan officer is going to be so that seller feels confident accepting your offer because they want a smooth escrow. And I say, hey, Mr. and Mrs. Listing Agent, our buyers might not have the best offer right now, but we're going to be the best escrow. I can guarantee you that. So consider us at least for a counter offer so we can stay in the game and get these folks in. That's going above and beyond because the longer that buyer is shopping around for homes, 4 weeks, 3 months, 6 months, home prices are going up, right? Remember the person that was just, what's your rate?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so $50 different than payment, but I got you in contract 6 months earlier because of the extra effort we're putting in together, and that home would have gone up $50,000. And oh, by the way, if you didn't buy it $50,000 cheaper and ride the equity up, that's $50,000 you lost going up and $50,000 more you had to buy the home. It's $100,000. And by the way, your property taxes now are going to be more too. So I'm going to do everything I can to get you into a property along with the real estate agent as quick and efficiently as possible. And that's where all that hidden savings is. And you're not going to lose the next 3-4 months giving up all your weekends house hunting.
Exactly. That's a good point there.
And you're that much more into paying a mortgage down.
Yeah.
There's so much there that the buyer doesn't even know to ask, hey, what's your rate? I mean, they just don't know.
Oh, yeah. No. And I've been just as guilty of that with some other things I can't think of right now where it's okay, who's the cheapest right now for whatever it is I'm looking for. I'm just as much guilty as that. But then it's conversations like
this.
Yeah. It's conversations like this where you realize even if I have to spend more, if I have the right person that gets it done right, it's worth it long term.
Yes.
I just can't see it this very minute.
Yeah. You don't know what you don't know.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. How about this? This is another good question. We live in an area, well, I'll put it this way. In most places around the country, it just makes much more sense to buy than it does to rent. Almost everywhere you go in the country. And there's a few unique markets like maybe Manhattan or San Francisco specifically, where because of the nature of the way the cities are laid out, in many cases, it can be cheaper to rent than it can be to buy.
Yeah.
However, for some people who maybe they're used to a rent that's a good amount, let's say $2,000 a month, they're used to paying rent, but they want to buy. Now buying, because they might be in one of those reverse environments, even if they have a good down payment, that $2,000 rent might go up to a $3,000 or $4,000 mortgage, which can be a hit for some people. So for conversations like that, we're like, hey, yeah, I get you're paying $2,000 a month in rent and you want to buy this house that you can afford by the numbers here, but your costs are going to go up to maybe about $4,000 a month between your mortgage, insurance, maintenance, whatever, plan for that much. How much of a deal breaker can that be for some people who haven't thought of it that way? They just say, I pay this much in rent, I want to pay that much in mortgage, not thinking about the everything else that comes with it.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And you know, one of the things we talk about right away too is understanding the potential tax deduction savings they're going to get. And again, I'm not a tax advisor, right? Got to throw that out there. Always talk to a tax professional because everyone's write-off ability may vary. But typically property taxes, a portion of that should be deductible and the interest you pay on your mortgage is deductible. So we got to factor that in. Mm. Obviously when you're renting, many times you don't have maintenance around the house, you know, landscaping to take care of that you will when you have a house. All right, so you got to factor that in. Someone wants to get a condo versus a single family. They go, I don't want to pay HOA. Great, you're going to pay a lot of maintenance for landscapers on your house. So we kind of look at all that. But it gets down back to really, what are you comfortable paying? Like I usually start off with clients. I always ask them, how much are you paying in rent right now? And they'll tell me and I'll write it down. And I say, okay, renting right now, let's say you're in your dream home as a renter. How high could that landlord raise that rent to where you're starting to choke on the payment every month? But there's no such thing as home ownership. There's only renting. So you can't go buy a home. You gotta still be a renter. Mm-hmm. What payment do you think you could afford? And they'll sit there and think, well, I'm paying $2,500. I could probably handle $4,000, Scott, something like that. I'm like, all right, great. Now we know that we can probably get into the $5,000 to $6,000 range for your mortgage, your taxes, your insurance because of the deductibility factor, right? And then we're gonna look at your debt to income ratios and see how that works out. So it's a starting point where they start to understand, right? We're talking generalities, but I get them understanding that there's a difference between what you pay in rent, where there's no deductions, and what I can do with buying a house, where there are. And oftentimes when you don't have that explanation with a borrower, like a loan officer that's not doing their job, they may just go, how much do you think you can afford? And then the buyer winds up buying a home that wasn't quite what they wanted, but probably could have gotten had they understood this concept, mm-hmm. if it was explained to them. You know what I mean? So it's having those kind of conversations that are super important with the client. But that's kind of how I walk them through it. I want them to understand the renting concept versus the home ownership concept. Completely different. But like you said, there's different expenses you're going to have that are kind of hidden, right? That you're not thinking about, you know, mm-hmm. all that maintenance and things breaking down and, you know, that is an added expense. And then it also gets into how do they handle their money? Do they have a lot of reserves? You don't have to really worry about them. Hey, these guys are on a razor thin edge. They're buying a home that's really kind of beat up. Their income to debt ratios are too high. I'm gonna have a whole different conversation with them mm-hmm. than the person that's financially savvy, has got a lot of money in the bank and it's not gonna be an issue.
Got it.
You know?
Do most people end up buying a home? Because we talked about how home purchases are emotional, which they mostly are.
Yeah.
Talk about the difference between that and the investor person. The person's like, yeah, I want to get in the real estate market, but this is just an investment to build my portfolio. Maybe I just need some that's cookie cutter. Maybe they want to do Airbnb, although I don't know, people are doing that nowadays because
yeah.
it's the market kind of got saturated with that.
It did.
But the person who wants to invest in real estate for the investment versus mm-hmm. the person that says, this is my dream home, raise the kids here, I'm going to redo the kitchen and the bathrooms and everything like that. How does each person think yeah. differently about what they can or cannot afford?
Yeah, that's a great question. First of all, one's going to be more emotional. It's going to be the person that's buying a home as a primary residence for themselves. Where's that neighborhood going to be? What's the commute going to be for me to work? What's the school district for my kids? Things of that nature, right? The investor is more going to be a little more analytical. You know, what's the cash flow going to be? How much do I have to put down? Because I know I got to put more down. It's investment property. Lenders are going to look at that property as more risk. So more equity is required right out of the gate, okay? Minimum, in some cases, can be about 15% down. But the sweet spot's gotten to where it's 25%. You're going to spend a lot of money in points if you're going dropping down to 20 to 15%
as an investment property. Okay.
They're more, and it's just more risk because you're not living in it, taking care of it. That's why investment properties are riskier.
Oh.
You got tenants in there. Tenants don't take care. That asset is that lender's asset too. In fact, they've invested more in than you have. Hmm. Your down payment's one quarter of what they have invested in it. You might stop making payments one day. They got to take that home back. Maybe market drops, you stop making payments. They got to sell that property now. Did the tenant destroy things on the way out, pour concrete down the toilet, you know, break all the windows, right? So a lot of that stuff happened back in 2008, 2009, right? So it used to be 20% down was a good sweet spot. Now it's 25, you know? So anyway, the mindset is what's my cash flow going to be like? Interest rates are a little bit higher on rental properties. It varies, but typically about 0.5% or so higher. And so they're thinking, all right, What's the probability that I can maintain a tenant in this area? You know, is it saturated with too many rentals and I'm going to have a property that I'm making payments on that I am not generating any revenue on? Or is it in an area like a university where there's always going to be college kids that I can keep renting it out to? Mm-hmm. So they're looking at it more analytically and not so emotionally. And that's really kind of the major difference between the two. You get away with lower down payments when you're buying a primary residence because you're going to live in it and you're more likely to take great care of it. So lower rates, lower down payment.
Interesting. So the same house, if person A is buying it as an investment, hey, I live in across the country, this is just an investment property because it's in a good area, whatnot, versus the person that wants to buy it because they want to live in there for 30 years, the same selling price, the person who wants to live in it as a primary residence could get away with a lower down payment versus the person who wants to buy the same property.
And lower rates. Yep.
Really?
Absolutely. It's just, think of it just like life insurance, right? You got a husband and wife and, you know, one person, does marathons and super healthy, and the other spouse is, you know, choking down 3 Big Macs a day. Their life insurance policy is going to be different. Mm. Same age, you know, take 2 twin brothers and auto insurance and both driving the same, sports car, and one person's got a ticket and an accident, and the other person's got a perfect driving record. Same age, they're going to have different policies. All risk-based. Lending, also risk-based.
Gotcha. How about that? So what's a typical percentage you should have for a down payment if around here, if you are going to be a primary residence?
Good question. So typically, you probably heard
20% was the gold standard for the longest time.
Well, and the only reason why that really is it's people trying to avoid what we call PMI, private mortgage insurance.
Yeah.
And there's different versions of it for FHA. They call it MMI, and there's on VA they have a funding fee and things of that nature. But what that is what I just talked about a minute ago. It's to compensate for risk. If the buyer's required to bring in more money, they're bringing more skin in the game. Lenders like that. Hey, you're more of a participant in this with us. When you hit 20%, you've given us enough comfortable cushion that if there's a slight market drop and you stop making payments, I can get a hold of that property, market it, sell it, recover that loan. That's what that cushion is doing, okay? Well, we know it's not realistic for everyone to come up with that kind of money, particularly in the Bay Area. Well, we shouldn't keep homeowners from having the opportunity to buy a home. So how do we get past that hurdle? You have private mortgage insurance. So basically, borrowers are paying into a fund every month, and it's called mortgage insurance, and it's not protecting the buyer. It's really for the lender, in a sense, because the lender now has protection should anything happen, because they're taking that chance, allowing a lower down payment. They don't have as much equity right out of the gate. That's riskier. So the mortgage insurance makes up for that. Okay.
Gotcha.
So that's what that does. And so you can do as little as 5% down, have mortgage insurance. On an FHA loan, the average is a 3.5% down payment, and you got mortgage insurance on that as well.
So but should you view mortgage insurance like rent, where you're throwing your money away, if you want to call it that term, because maybe you want to buy that $1 million home and you only have whatever, $50,000 down, which is what, 5%? And you have to make up that difference. So the money that you have to put into that PMI forever, how many, many, many years, you never get that money back. So do you look at that cost saying, hey, your PMI is going to be kind of high, you should really think about a lower value property or wait till you get your down payment up? How do you have that conversation? And is there a magic number where you say, you might have PMI, but it's nothing?
That. Let's look at it. Let's say PMI is $100 a month. It's only $1,200 in a year. What's that $1 million home going to be in a year at 4% increase? $1,040,000. It's $40,000. You trade $1,200 for $40,000 in equity, plus you paid down on a mortgage, plus you got tax deductions, plus you're a homeowner. See how it doesn't even compute? It's easy, right? So mortgage insurance, minor speed bump. Take it. No big deal. No big deal at all. Cost of doing business to get wealthy in real estate in the Bay Area, right? So not a big deal. And you don't have to have it forever. Usually you got to have it for a couple of years till you get 20% equity. Mm-hmm. And in some cases you can, let's say that you put down 10% and you know in a year you're going to get a really big bonus. Well, if you were buying a $1 million home and you took a $900,000 loan, 10% down, but you're going to get a $100,000 bonus in a year, oftentimes you can take that $100,000, prepay down on the mortgage and say, hey, lender, I now got the down payment I should have had in the beginning. Can you please lift the mortgage insurance? You can do that. When you're doing it the slow route, you got to let your home go up in value. You keep paying it down. You get to a 20% equity position or margin, right? my home at 900,000 to now a million, I only owe 800,000. I've got that 20% equity. Get an appraisal, prove it, show the lender, remove your mortgage insurance in most cases.
So it goes up to 20% based on the value of the house later on, not what you bought it for. If you buy a house now and then 5 years later, the value goes up.
You get to use that.
Okay.
So compared to what you owe. So it's going up and you're going down. You're getting to count all that. Because remember, it's back to a look at right now. What is the equity position you are leaving me with as a lender if I lift the mortgage insurance? Oh, I easily got the 20%. Why would I not allow that to happen? Mm-hmm. So absolutely, you can do it that way. Yeah.
Interesting. Now, hypothetically, because we don't see this happen in the Bay Area, but let's just say it did. You have a massive influx of inventory that comes on the market. People just say, you know what? We're 20 years down the line. A lot of people just don't want to live in the Bay Area anymore. They just want to get rid of their homes. And it's the baby boomer generation and their kids don't want the homes. And for some reason, there's a massive influx of inventory in the Bay Area. Or whatever you want to call a massive influx of inventory. Sure. But the numbers go up like, oh, we have, it's not 6%. It's like maybe we have 10% vacancy rate, whatever. Even in that case there, where there's more supply than there is demand, do you really see homes in that scenario? Would they even drop? And if they did, would they drop a little bit? Or pretty much, even if you took a little bit of a hit, that risk, if that were even to happen, is you're not going to lose half your house's value kind of a thing.
No, you're not. There's no more buildable land. You know, you're usually now you're having to tear stuff down to rebuild, right? Mm-hmm. There's a ton of wealth in the Bay Area. This is what's causing so many problems for a lot of the lower income people that, you know, that want to own property. It's not likely that unless there's something really, really tragic that we're going to have a lot of inventory open up. Some of the biggest problems causing that right now is that we had super low rates in the twos and threes back in the early 2020s, right? And so many people are saying, this is an incredible investment. This property I got, I'm paying 2.625 rate. I look at my mortgage statement and I'm like, my gosh, $2,000 a month is paying down my mortgage every month. Whereas if I'm at, you know, 6-7%, maybe 900 is paying down my mortgage. So they don't want to let go of those properties. They look at it like legacy wealth. They'll turn it into a rental. You know, a property that I own right now, I have at a really low rate. I got a VA loan on it in the low twos, and that property is going to be a rental property for me when I move. I'd be crazy to sell that property, you know, because when someone comes in and starts making that mortgage payment for me, they're knocking down so much of my principal. And so that is causing a big problem. Now, to your question about the inventory, yeah, if the inventory opens up, you're going to see a slowing of property values because listing agents, sellers that are going to put their home up and list their home, they're going to have competition with other people selling their homes, and the buyers can be a little bit more choosy. We haven't seen that for a while. It'd be nice to get back to that, you know? But as long as inventory is tight, you're not ever going to see a big drop in home prices. Now, when interest rates drop, what's going to happen? Most people in their minds, they need a sub 6% before they jump into the market. It's psychological, right? So many of them waiting to get back to the fives. When they start flooding the market and with low inventory, supply and demand, unfortunately, home prices are going to go up.
So even if you got a situation where you buy a home and for whatever reason, it just doesn't appreciate, in 15 years, it has a very, very low appreciation, maybe like 2-3% or whatever, versus what we've been seeing now. Even in that example, because you own it, you're still making out better than maybe the person that bought the home in 1975, sold it in 2005 and made a ton of money because they just happened to be in at the right time. Even if though you may not have that, it's still a benefit for you. Because some people will look at that number and say, well, if this home only appreciates, let's say, 2 or 3% a year, maybe they live in Illinois or something like that in a different area. And then they look at the stock market and they say, well, this has been doing 7% or 8% annually over the year. Am I better putting that money towards investments in the market versus, you know, buying a home that's going to grow very slowly?
I there's a lot in that question. You phrased it perfectly. Every situation is different. If you're buying in another part of the country, if you can get, I mean, the stock returns you're going to get are independent of where you live. Mm-hmm. But if you live in an area where home prices aren't going up very much and your rent is going to be really low, sure, there's something to be said about that. You know, renting could be a viable option. But in the Bay Area, we're in our own little bubble. Mm-hmm. Those home prices are massive. So if a home, $1 million home goes up 1% a year, it's $10,000. What'd you do to earn that? Wrote a contract, bought the house. But we know that's not the case. They go up more than that, okay? I was looking at a chart the other day from 1941 to the chart went to like 2023. It was like 5 or 6 years were the only years where the values dropped. The rest, it was increasing anywhere from 1% to like 8 or 9% per year. So it's statistical that your home's gonna keep going in value. We've got more people, we've got less housing, people need housing. And in the Bay Area, leverage $1 million property, 10 years from now, you're gonna be pretty happy you did. The hard part is getting people in that can't afford it.
Yeah, and obviously affordability is a big question here, but let's go back to that example I gave of the average. Let's say we picked $150,000, your household income, maybe you got a married couple, they both work at Google or something like that. Maybe you can push that to $200,000 for some of the tech people around
here. I'll be honest, I see clients, the husband makes $250,000, the wife makes $250,000.
All right. So let's take that then. That's about a $500,000 household income.
Yeah.
If debt was very manageable and they did all the right things, like you're saying, what would probably be the value of a home that they could realistically afford?
They're pushing into the $2 million plus for sure.
Mm. Gotcha.
You know, and you know.
We're not saying without debt, but maybe a sub 20% down payment. We're still talking they could get into that range.
Yeah, it's possible. More limited because the ratios, when you start getting up into what we call jumbo loans. Mm-hmm. Jumbo loans are when we're not talking Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, your typical conventional loan across the nation. Mm-hmm. We're in a high cost area here. So those loans go up to $1,149,825. Once you get over that, you're in the jumbo market. Mm-hmm. Now, when you're in the jumbo market, you're not under the Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac guidelines. So I call it the Wild West. Every lender that's lending on a jumbo loan kind of writes their own rules, okay? Because they're not selling them off to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. So some may say, we're not going to let you have DTI ratios more than 38 or 43. Some will go to 45. But now they're, okay, it's a lot of money you're borrowing. So now we're also not only going to make you have your closing costs, your down payment, you're going to have reserves. 6 months times your payment or 12 months times your payment, okay? So what happens is you've got, I can afford more home, but I've got more restrictions on my debt to income ratio. Hmm. Now the lower borrower making less income, we can push those income to debt ratios higher, okay, with a little bit less income. So they might have to stretch a little bit more to make it work to get closer to the person that's making more money. They can choose to live a little bit more comfortably. But if you're not making it, let's talk about other ways to do it. I encourage a lot. Let's talk about a phenomenon. You're probably going to ask me this question. How do we get a lot of these buyers that are struggling into homes? And there's many ways, and it often requires help. And what I'm seeing a lot happen right now is parents are getting involved. Parents are helping with down payment. Parents are co-signing. Now there can be some challenges with that, some pitfalls that we gotta be aware of. And I have a client right now that I've been dealing with. The parents are helping co-sign, and I said, "You understand, right? We're bringing together both incomes, bringing together both debts. Are they gonna help you make the payment? Because I can now qualify you for more to get into the house that you'd like to get into. Mm-hmm. You still got to make the payment." How are you gonna do that? Oh, my parents aren't gonna really help. Okay, and are we gonna get a roommate? You know, because you're not gonna be able to make the payment. Let's go back to the instrument panel. Our debt to income ratio with just you is 61. With your parents is 35. But you gotta make the payment of a 61 DTI loan. So that's where, again, a loan officer not looking out for their client is not gonna talk to them about that and let the emotion from the buyer cloud their judgment. Well, mom and dad's helped me. I can buy this $750,000 condo on my $100,000 income that they shouldn't be buying unless they have a plan. Mom and dad's going to help make the payment, or I'm going to get a roommate. It's going to rent out a room for me. Now, we can't use that rental income that you're getting. That's called border income. Can't use it, but at least I know you can handle the payment. So now it's a different conversation about them moving forward.
Gotcha. You know? Yeah, you're right. That was one of the questions I was going to ask you. Talk about the difference between these FHA loans, VA loans, conventional loans, and jumbo loans.
Yeah.
And for the most part here in the Bay Area, which we're talking about jumbo loans, correct? Just because of the value of the properties.
Or bigger down payments. What's nice is those Fannie Mae loans that are less restrictive, like the jumbos are, they keep rising as home prices keep going up, right? Because it's all based on a formula off of the average median income. And so we're up to almost $1,150,000, right? When I started out, conforming loans were, I think they were sub 200, you know, back in the late 90s. And now they're pushing $1,150,000 right now and may go up again, you know, next year. So oftentimes, a lot of people that have great incomes that may come here from, you know, from other countries or what have you that start working in the tech industry, they get really big salaries right out of the gate. But they haven't been working long enough to accumulate $400,000 or $500,000, so they might want to go 10% down or 15% down, and so now it gets into, well, we don't have any reserves, so we might have to get the reserves in order to do this. So maybe we have to put enough down to just get to the Fannie Mae loan, $1,149,825, so that we don't have the reserve issue. Or you can get creative. Also, you can actually split it into two loans. So let's say we want to buy a home and we want to take a first mortgage at $1,149,825 and another $100,000 as a second mortgage called a piggyback loan and put it behind the two. So now we get to work within the guidelines of Fannie Mae that don't require all the reserves, put less down and have a second mortgage. Now we got two mortgages. We actually borrowed more like a jumbo, but kind of fell into that loophole of it not being jumbo by splitting it into two parts. So there's a lot of creative things like that.
So like that one, for example,
yeah,
it sounds like it's really good, but what are some of the pitfalls when you do that? When you do that piggyback loan, okay, we got the numbers to work. This is what comes with it. So you're aware of it. What would that conversation be like?
The only major difference is that, the piggyback loan often is going to be an adjustable loan. So the interest rate's going to be a little bit higher, but they also would have had mortgage insurance. Right? If they didn't have the piggyback loan. That's another way to avoid the mortgage insurance too, because we're borrowing more than 80% loan to value, right? And we get to avoid that non-deductible mortgage insurance. And just side note, mortgage insurance can be deductible in some situations for certain low-income borrowers. Just side note for your viewers. But typically at that level, you're not writing off mortgage insurance. And that's another way to avoid it. And that might be that type of tech person is going to get a bonus coming up, and they can pay off that second in 6 months or whatever. So not a big deal. Again, it goes back to, what are the ratios? What's your financial profile look like? Do you understand what we're doing? Yes, we do. Okay, this is going to work out just great.
Okay, so in that example there, if you take out a piggyback mortgage, let's say $100,000, you could pay that off faster because it's an adjustable rate, where it may be good right now, but if those rates go up, then your payments end up going up. So you can pay that off first and then, okay.
Yeah, that's what I tell people. If you want to pay off your mortgage faster, don't do it on the first, do it on the second. Just start knocking that thing down. The other thing cool about that, which a lot of people don't realize, if you split it into two, once you get rid of the piggyback loan, your overall mortgage payment has dropped because you eliminated a payment. If you took out 90% one loan with mortgage insurance, you can't lower that loan amount down, that payment. You can lower the loan amount, but you can't lower the payment.
Got it. Okay.
So a lot of times that's an attractive way to get the home you want, because that's always number one. I want that home. How do we make it work? And then talk about pros and cons of both options.
Got it. Okay. So even if you take a conventional loan out, but you don't max it, you can still get a piggyback loan on top of it. Let's say the max is 1.1 or whatever it is. Let's say you want to take out $900,000 on a conventional.
Yep, keep it at 80%.
Yeah.
And then take the rest out on a second. You can do that.
And then that, once you pay that second mortgage off, your now primary conventional loan mortgage is a lot more of a manageable payment.
Correct.
And we're still talking about 30 years?
Yep.
That's another thing, since we brought that up.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the difference between these 15, 30, 40, 45-year loans.
Correct.
And what's... It sounds like it's way more attractive if you get a 15-year loan and you do that. Hey, you can pay that house off faster. You'll earn more equity. And if you get a 45-year loan, then you're probably paying more in interest at the end of the day, but we can get you in the better home. What are some of the main pros and cons of those three different types of years?
Great, great question. All right. So the typical loan payoffs are going to be 30 is the most common. There are 40. I haven't seen 45. It may exist. I haven't seen it. There is 40, but you are going to pay a much higher interest rate because you're taking so much longer to pay the lender back. And so even though your payment's a little bit lower, your you are paying more for that home long term. So I try to encourage at least a minimum 30 if you can do it. Okay. Then you got a 15. Now some people go, wow, that's exciting. I'm going to pay my mortgage off in 15 years. All right. Well, nothing wrong with that. That's great. You're going to save a lot in interest. But what interest rate are you at? Like, mine's pretty low. It's in the low twos right now. I'm not accelerating it right now. I'd rather put more into retirement or investments or whatever, right? Because the home is going up in value, irregardless of whether I have a mortgage on it or not. And if I'm not getting charged a lot of interest of leverage, why not do that, okay? Now, I'll tell people sometimes that are looking at buying a home with a 15-year mortgage, I'll say, did you know you can take out a 30 and pay it off like a 15? You're in charge. You put your foot on the gas, right? So if I have a 30-year mortgage at 6% and a 15-year mortgage, let's just say it's also at 6%. We always know that 15 years are roughly half a percent lower, okay? But if I take the 30 and the 15 next to each other, same rate, and the 30 person makes the payment that the 15-year is forced to make, mm-hmm. they will pay off on the same day, pay the exact same amount in interest. But the 30-year person has insurance built in. Unforeseen challenges in life down the road where they might not be able to make that much higher payment on the 15. Mm. Fall back right. on the 30 for a few months and then get back on the horse again and put your foot back on the gas and keep on with your plan. The 15 is forced to make that payment.
Gotcha. Okay. So you don't really see a lot of 15 years. There's really no incentive.
Not in a low interest rate market. Mm. Not even in a high. Right? So you see it often when people are preparing for retirement. They can afford it. They want the discipline of it, right? Your first-time buyer, I rarely ever see, wants to do anything lower than a 30. They just want to get their feet wet, get used to making a mortgage payment. And then here's another thing. A lot of lenders out there will refinance a client when rates come down, say they've been in the loan 2 or 3 years, and they won't even bring up, hey, you're already 3 years into this loan. I know the rate's coming down, but if we go back to 30, we're resetting the interest back to 30. We know over time, we're slowly amortizing that principal till it's paid off. By the word amortization, mortuary, death, it's to kill off your loan, right? So I always suggest, hey, let's take out a 27-year now. You've been in your loan for 3 years. Let's keep you on that path and suggest a 27. Or they go, you know what, Scott, we're worried about job instability down the road. Great, let's go back to a 30. But let me show you what a payment looks like at 27. So you keep making that 27-year payments. You stay on the path you were on. So by the time you get ready to retire, there's a chance you're going to have your home paid off.
Hmm. Very interesting.
Not everybody talks like that to their clients. They're not thinking forward for them. They don't know this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Help them understand it.
I mean, it sounds like it makes sense to pay your home off faster because you own it faster. But with the way some of these loans are structured, it may benefit you to take your time paying it off because of the way that you can invest some of the other money that you have that you're forced to pay for a 15-year loan into something else. So yeah, I've heard that conversation, but it's hard to understand.
I will say, for the person that doesn't invest any money, just scared, doesn't want to do anything with the market. Those are the people that I will say, hey, why don't we consider paying off your mortgage a little faster? You've got all this extra money. You really don't want to put a lot of it over into the stock market or even your retirement, or maybe you maxed out your retirement. You still got extra money, but you don't want to invest it in other avenues. Then it might be okay to pay off that tax deductible mortgage a little faster and be debt free sooner. Mm-hmm. So everybody's situation and mindset on how they look at what's their investing risk, if you will, we have to look at that on its own merit every time.
Got it. Okay. I've heard about this and kind of explain this for everybody. What's a reverse mortgage?
Excellent question. And it gets a lot of bad rap. A reverse, I want you to think about it, is opposite of what we've been talking about, a forward mortgage. We're moving forward, paying it down over time. A reverse means it's going to reverse. It's going to go up in value. The loan's going to grow. So it allows seniors, especially seniors that, have built up a ton of equity in their home, right? The ability to pay off that mortgage that's a forward one that maybe they can't afford as much anymore. Health costs might be rising. Maybe they're down to one income. It's fixed. And they want to live in that home. It's their home. They've been in it for 20, 30 years. They can take out a reverse mortgage and essentially pay off that mortgage and not make a mortgage payment anymore. Now, they're making it, but just in reverse. They're not being forced to make a payment. They're adding it on to the back of the loan. So it's going in reverse. It's growing over time. Okay? So essentially now, whatever cash flow they do earn, whether it's from retirement or a pension or what have you, a big portion of it was going to the mortgage while they live in the home. Now it's not going to the mortgage, and they still get to live in the home. They can live in that home for the rest of their lives, even if that mortgage ever got upside down. But it's very unlikely that it will, because the lenders are going to calculate the age of the borrower, the size of the loan, and the value of the home at time of closing. And they're projecting out that there's still going to be a lot of equity for that borrower, even when they pass one day. Because it'd be a bad bet for the lender, wouldn't it? They'd have people outliving and having homes worth less than what it's accumulated to, and then the lenders lose. And they're taking that bet. So that's why they're going to start out conservatively. That's why a lot of people that don't have a lot of equity in their homes, they're not going to qualify for a reverse mortgage.
Got it. So this is more for the senior community who's been in that house for 20 years.
Correct.
And they've built up, you know, a lot of equity in there. By doing a reverse mortgage, you're essentially paying less for what you owe, but the rest is coming out of the equity. If that
Correct.
Makes sense.
So it's growing over time. So you look at your statement on a forward mortgage and you go, oh man, we paid down $1,500 this month. Excellent. I keep seeing it go down. They're going to look at their statement and see it's growing up. But remember, you have to live. Money's got to come from somewhere. Often a lot of these folks have money with financial planners that they're trying to keep that money growing and try not to let the balance come down because the senior's drawing income off of that. Well, this works great with somebody that's got a portfolio that wants to keep drawing that same type of money off out of that portfolio and have the financial planner protect that money for them. And you start taking it out of your home. It's just a different bucket, right? So now they're used to the income they already have over here, and they're just extracting money out of the equity of their home. And at the end of the day, we came into this planet naked and we're leaving naked. They're not taking any of that equity with them.
Yep.
It's just money from one particular bucket. And oftentimes, that's a good bucket to get that money from. They can also draw a home equity line of credit off of that and have access to more funds if they wish down the road. They could draw a monthly paycheck if they like. They could take out a lump sum if they like. They could do a combination of all three if they like, provided there's enough equity to do that.
Interesting. There's so much about these that most people don't even understand. You heard these terms, reverse mortgage, second mortgage, PMI insurance, and it's all like just numbers on a plate. Like, I have no clue what this actually means. And most people probably say, you know what? I want that home. It costs this much. How do I get in there? Do you think it's a good thing or a bad thing when people say, for better or for worse, they're just looking at the monthly payment? If I can make that number, tell me how to get there, then I'm golden. Do you think that's a good mindset to have or not?
No. Because they're not thinking of all, like we talked about earlier, all the other potential expenses that home ownership is going to bring. I mean, to me, home ownership is the best thing in the world. But you got to go in understanding the ramifications of how much mortgage you've taken on, the size of the house you've taken on. The bigger the house, the more expensive to heat it, to cool it, to maintain it. Mm-hmm. How much lawn do you got to take care of? Is it low maintenance, high, a lot of maintenance? You know, you got to think of all these things. Now, obviously, someone has really, really incredible income. They don't have to think of some of the things that a lot of the regular rest of us have to think about going in. And you know, if anything, my hopes is that, you know, today's podcast helps your listeners really start to think about all these other things, because it is so easy to just emotionally go, I want that house. I don't care how I got to get in, you know? And that's exciting. I don't want to take that away, but you got to think through it a little bit, make sure you really understand the numbers and just make sure it's going to be comfortable for you.
We talked about this earlier when we said, think about the debt you're going to have in the future that you don't have now. Maybe you're going to need a new car in 5 years. Another one that's was big for a lot of people is maybe you're buying a house. Let's say you're a newly married couple and you're buying a house now and you have your debts where they're at. Maybe they're really good. You have good amount of savings. But now you're projecting in 2 years, you're going to start a family.
Mm-hmm.
And now you have to add the cost of the kids coming in.
Right.
Food, insurance, clothes, all that good stuff there. When you do your calculations, do you also account for, hey, you guys want to have two kids? Okay, great. This is what you're probably going to have to think about spending, and how is that going to factor into your mortgage?
If I'm honest, I don't know that we go that deep into it. We we definitely look at what their debts are. And again, it's that we'll probably talk about that if I know we're really pushing those ratios high.
Okay.
If I'm not, and I see financially that they understand how to manage your money well, they keep their debt really low, I can see that they know that they're not going to get themselves into any financial situation that would be uncomfortable to them. They'll know as they go. They have another child. Okay, we built up some equity. We need a bigger home. It's time to move, you know? So we talk about it a little bit, but not a lot. And I can tell you that, again, I've never once had someone come back and say, man, I wish you had talked to me about three kids, Scott. We didn't have those kids. Now we do. And I'm out of the house. You know, it just kind of naturally works out that they get into a situation that they can afford. And I, like I said, I make sure that they're financially savvy, especially if they're going to have higher debt to income ratios. Then we probably are having that conversation.
Perfect. Have you?
Kids are expensive.
I believe that they are. Do you have conversations where maybe somebody says, I want this $2 million home, and you're like, hey, based on the numbers, for you to live comfortably and whatever, we need to get you down to $1.5 million house, or save up an extra couple $100,000 in a couple years, which is not realistic for many people. So for those people in that situation there, have you seen that happen a lot?
Yeah.
Where you've had to come, like, hey, come back to reality.
Good question. First of all, what I try to do is, I like to teach in a way that makes them see the answer on their own. Like, hey, this $2 million home you want, here's your payment. Here's your income you just showed me. Here's what you're paying now. How are you going to make that? How do you make that payment? What's going to be left over after you make that payment? You know, and usually when, you know, I say, okay, there's a reason why we have debt to income ratios. Yeah, it's to protect the lenders, but it's to protect you too. Okay. Because part of the problem was, back in 2007 and 2006, right? When there were loans where you just had to fog a mirror.
That was the Wild West back
then. People were getting loans they shouldn't be getting. Why? Because we allowed emotion to get in. Okay. And that doesn't exist right now. You can't do that. Now, there are some loan programs that we can do what we call no ratio with a large down payment. And again, I look at that borrower as, well, why are we doing no ratio? Oh, it's because you have an inheritance coming of $1 million in a year, and you're putting 20% down because you've got cash. So we don't have to look at your income, because I know you just got laid off from a job. You're not going to qualify and you need to buy this house. But your credit's great. You got a ton of money coming. So there are loans to fit that niche for people that want to buy real estate, but they don't fit the big box, you know? But yeah, it all gets down to, again, asking the right questions of the homeowner, making them think, and then showing them, hey, there's a reason why you're not going to be able to afford this home. Now, at the end of the day, if we can make it work and they're just adamant about it and they're going to go down the street and get it anyway, I have to ask myself, you know, do I really want to help them still? Or do I think it's in their best interest that I don't help them and let them go somewhere else, because I think they're going to put themselves in a really tough spot? I, you know, that's a tough conversation, but it doesn't happen too often, thankfully.
Good. It doesn't happen.
Most people, they self-protect themselves and know what a comfortable payment's going to be. Oftentimes, I tell them, what do you think's a good payment for you? Well, plug it all in. I go, look at that. You're right in where those ratios should be. There's a reason why lenders set it up that way. Because even you know you're not more comfortable than X.
Gotcha. It's funny. I did a mortgage calculator the other day just for kicks and giggles. And I thought, okay, here's what I make. Here's my debt. Here's my interest, whatever. And it estimated that, you know, your monthly payments are like double what the mortgage is, because it's factoring in property taxes, PMI, whatever. And it says you can afford a house here. I'm like, wow, for the Bay Area, that's not the number I thought I was going to see. But then it really showed me, hey, it's factoring in that you're probably going to have a lot of maintenance and you're going to have to pay all this. And it does. I'm assuming it doesn't account for that mortgage insurance being deducted.
Correct. It doesn't.
So it just
They're basic. It's to try to draw you into that website, start filling stuff out, and hopefully you're going to maybe give some information, maybe an email address, get to do a loan with that company, you know, is what they're hoping. Think about this too. The other beauty of homeownership is, compared to a renter, is your rent's going to keep going up. Your landlord's going to keep raising that rent. When you buy a house, your costs kind of get pretty fixed. Yeah, you're going to have slight increases in your property tax. Your insurance may go up a little bit here and there, but you know you can make that payment on today's income. With rent, it's going to keep going up, and you're not paying anything down. The other thing is that if you're in your working years, your income's going to keep going up. So if you can buy a house at a price here, your income's going to keep going up. I can refinance, keep bringing my payment down, all the while building equity and wealth. It's a no-brainer. Mm-hmm. It's a no-brainer. There are rare occasions, though, where rent is a better option, particularly, let's say I'm going to move in a year or two. I don't know. I might get a job transfer or I'm going to get married and, you know, the spouse wants to move somewhere else. Why would we buy a house right now? Because you got the expense of buying the house, the expense of selling the house. Did the property even go up enough to cover that? So you don't want to buy a house that's going to be less than 2 years unless you're going to get into some flipping or, you know, and you're buying it low and you're going to put a bunch of money into it, sell it high and make an equity spread there. But that's another thing to think about where renting might make more sense. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, and if you just, you really don't like to deal with maintenance, you got cheap rent and you're really savvy in the stock market and that floats your boat. Hey, nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with that at all. And that's just a personal choice. But for most family members, most wealth comes from real estate.
This is one I want to get to you because we have a new president in the Oval Office, or will be in January. This is being recorded in November.
Yeah.
And from the conservative point of view, there's a lot of excitement about what that's going to do for the market, for the interest rates, for the mortgage loan. As a mortgage person who wants to get everybody in the right house, what do you foresee is coming down the line in terms of what you can probably expect from it? No one can predict it. Yeah. I understand that. But what do you anticipate is going to happen with interest rates and what maybe some of these loan terms can be changed? Like, what do you see coming up?
So interest rates are high. Inflation's been high. There's a lot of excitement going on right now. You saw that the stock market's just done. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when there's when stocks typically go up, you're going to find mortgage rates tend to go up too, because money's not moving into bonds, mm-hmm. right? They're going into stocks. Like what happened during COVID, everyone started putting money into bonds. Well, you start flooding bonds, the yields come down, so interest rates come down, right? So it's kind of like, where are you going to get a lot of your benefit? You know, your 401k and your stocks are doing wonderful, and sometimes interest rates are going to go up. You know, Trump's talking about, you know, tariffs and things of that nature, and there's some economists that are saying, you know, that could cause some inflation. And, you know, if that happens, we could see rates kind of stay where they are for a while. But, you know, and there's a lot of other things that he's talking about doing. You know, he wants to go after a lot of the illegal immigration. We know that in building homes, a lot of home building is from a lot of immigrants. They're doing a lot of the work, a lot of the labor. How's that going to affect the costs of labor for building homes? How many homes can be built? That affects inventory. Is inventory going to be lower? Is inventory going to be higher? That's going to affect costs of homes, right? Supply and demand. You know, there's a lot of regulation that he wants to, you know, deregulate. But there's things at the local level that federal regulations can't really, really handle. So there's like five or six things that are kind of unknown. But the general consensus from a lot of the economists are that by 2025 to 26, we're going to be in a range of 5.5 to 6.5. I believe we're going to get into the fives. I don't think we're probably going to get much lower than 5.5%. Is that helpful? On a $1 million mortgage, yeah, it's helpful. You know, you're talking a few hundreds of dollars right there per month. But getting back to the fours and threes and twos is probably not going to happen. So one of the things I want to really emphasize is, do not buy real estate if you can afford it based on interest rates, because right out of the gate, you're not establishing the price of the home, which means you can fall behind. Home goes up $20,000. Remember, I said it's double. You didn't ride the equity up. That's almost a $40,000 hit if you wait too long. Your property taxes are going to be higher. And guess what? You can only lock in that price of that home one time, but you can keep redoing your loan and ride interest rates down and make it more affordable. So, and the key, the smart people buy homes when no one else is, right? A lot of people are afraid because the interest rates are high right now. Yeah, granted, they're around low sevens right now as we speak as the recording of this on your 30-year fixed. Wouldn't it make sense to buy a home now at 7% if you can afford it, knowing that when they drop below 6 and everyone's flooding the market, causing those home prices to go up, and you're going to sit back, so glad I'm not giving up my weekends. I'm heading off to Carmel this weekend. Oh, and by the way, I'm refinancing my mortgage lover. I don't have to go out in the rat race and go look for homes, right? Mm-hmm. But to answer your question, yeah, I think that you're going to see it. It just really depends on a lot of factors and what the inflation rate does. And how did tariffs play into that? How does deregulation play into that? How's the housing market going to be? What's going on globally? All those things we can't control. But right now, they're going to probably stay a little higher, I think. And then I think it's going to get figured out, and they're going to find ways to bring the interest rates down. They're going to have to, because it's getting completely unaffordable.
It is. But then we look in the 1980s when we saw interest rates of like 18,
20%. 18%, 1981, so, yeah.
And people say that these are interest rates are high. They are, but compared to what they were, you know, 40 years ago, I mean, they're a drop in the bucket. But then I don't think we're going to get to that point again, because that was a whole different time.
And we will not.
A lot of dependence on foreign inputs that we don't have nowadays that keep these interest rates relatively low, even though they're higher than they were back in the pandemic. And that's the problem, is if you give low interest rates like what we had during the pandemic, people say that's the norm. Anything higher than that is too high, when really that was a rare exception. Like,
yeah,
that had to be for a certain reason, depending on who you are and if it generated money for the economy, which in a way it did, but that was a one-time thing. So get back to, okay, where should reality be? You're right, 5, 6, maybe 7% will be the new norm. It might go up a little bit, might go down a little bit. And if you buy at 7%, and you refinance when it goes down to 5.5%, well, sounds like you made a smart choice there.
Absolutely. And you're building wealth all along the way, and your income's rising, hopefully. You're in that kind of a career where it rises, and your fixed costs are dropping a little bit, you know, with the interest rates going down. You know, and you can always refinance, stretch back out to a 30 again if you need to lower your payments. There's a lot of things you can do. Mm-hmm. One of the things I want to mention, if it's okay, is ways to cover closing costs. Would that be helpful for your listeners? So, you know, there's a number of ways to do that.
And then also what they are.
Yeah.
Because most people are like, what is that?
Sure.
I mean, I don't.
Sure. So closing costs, you know, are typically approximately, it's not an exact number, 2% of the loan amount. And there's two types of expenses you're going to have there in addition to the down payment. Okay. So I always tell clients there's three things. Number one is your down payment. That's your skin in the game. It's the biggest number typically. Number two is going to be what we call non-recurring closing costs. I call those the transactional expenses. That's what gets me through the escrow. All the third-party services and vendors need to get paid to get you through an escrow. And then the third thing is going to be what we call recurring closing costs. I like to call it prepaid expenses. Those are the expenses of owning the property, kind of like the prorations of how much interest do I have for the rest of the month when I close escrow that I got to come in with, getting my insurance policy in place. What property taxes do I owe at this place in time, at this month, this day of the year, you know? And so typical non-recurring expense you're going to have, you're going to have an appraisal. You're going to have an underwriting fee. You're going to have things like an escrow. And again, a lot of these non-recurring transactional expenses are county dependent, city dependent. Some counties, buyers traditionally cover certain things. Other counties, it's more on the seller. And so you've got escrow fees, title insurance to make sure you're taking clear title, policy for the homeowner, policy for the lender. They need to be protected. They're a partner in this. You're going to have notary, recording, things of that nature. Okay, standard stuff. And so how do we, you know, we worked hard. We scraped up for the down payment, and now we got closing costs. How do we cover that? I don't have a lot. A few things you can do. There are some programs out there, first-time homebuyer programs. They come and go. They're county-based, they're city-based, federal-based, whatever. There's pros and cons to them. They limit your DTI you can go up to. Oftentimes that it makes it, well, then I can't get the home I really need to get to because you're making me have such a low DTI, right? Great product if you really need it and you don't have a lot of money. But if you come up with a minimum down payment, gosh, 3% on some conventional loans, 3.5% on FHA, you can go in and ask the seller for a credit. Hey, seller, could you help me out with $10,000? And one of the tactics, if they give you pushback, is, I know we talked to buy your house for $1 million. I'll give you $1,000,010. You'll still net $1 million. Kick me back 10 towards my closing costs. That would really help me out. Okay. You can also raise your interest rate because it's all about yield to the lender. If the average rate is 7, hey, lender, can I go to 7.25? I can see I'm going to get back $5,000 or $6,000 because they know they're going to yield more interest over the life of the loan. I'll get some lender credit back and finance it that way. You can get a gift from family. Okay. A lot of people don't realize that if they have a 401k with their current employer, typically you can borrow up to $50,000 or 50%, whichever is less, and borrow against it. Not withdraw it where you pay a penalty and get taxed on it. You're borrowing against it. They take payments back out of that, out of your paycheck to pay back that money. And guess what? They charge you an interest rate. And you know who that interest goes to?
Back to yourself.
You. Back to yourself. It's a great way to get an extra $50,000 that you worked hard to build up in that 401k. You can take out a home equity loan on another property you have. I don't recommend it, but you can go get a personal loan that's not, connected to anything, right? It's unsecured. Yeah. But you can do that if getting a home is worth it, and I think it is. You know, you're going to build a lot of wealth over time. So there's a lot of creative ways that you can get funds to help out with buying a home that's in addition to the down payment.
Interesting. Very. There was this thing I talked to about a buddy who sold cars, doesn't do it anymore. I said, what's the best way to get a best price on a car? Because the old thought was, if you show up there with cash, you know, you could buy a car outright. They might give you the best deals. And like, that might work specific times of the year, like at the end when they got to get rid of inventory. But for the most part, most of these dealerships, well, all dealerships, they make the money on the loan that they give you. So that's where they get all the money from. So if you go in and negotiate a lower rate, but you finance it, then that dealer will give you that lower rate, maybe, or maybe that lowest selling price on the car, but they're giving you a higher interest rate on the loan. Mm-hmm. And then all you do is, if you've got the cash, you just pay it off in one lump sum.
Right.
So you get a lower car price, they get their money from the lender, and you paid the loan back.
Just had a client call me on that the other day for buying for their daughter. Yep. That same conversation.
Same strategy.
They're going to pay 6 months on the loan and then pay the loan off.
Yeah.
I said it's going to build the daughter's credit as well, mm-hmm. and they get the better overall deal. Everybody won in that situation.
Now, is that something you could do in the housing market, considering that everything is out there on the table? Like, is there a way that you can negotiate for a closing cost, whatever, because you have cash on the side? Or no, that's all going to be on the
table
first.
Well, usually with cars, the lender and the car seller are all kind of together. You know, when you buy a house, you got a seller and you're coming along with the lender. So there's a distance between us. Now, there is something to be said that may whet a seller's appetite with all cash. Why? Well, there's no chance of fallout, or very low chance of fallout, if something goes wrong with the buyer's loan. They don't have to go through as lengthy of a process getting that loan all put together. So maybe they can close in 6 days, right? Mm-hmm. So there sometimes is incentive to accept an all cash offer. I've been in situations though where I've gotten sellers to accept offer with 5% down, and we beat out 2 all cash offers just because they loved the buyers. They loved the approach that I had with them when I called them, excuse me, and said how things were going to go and how the process was going to go, and gave our buyers an opportunity to also meet, you know, the price at least of the all cash. Now, it would have been easier for them just to take the all cash. And sometimes a seller might take an all cash offer if it's a little lower, just because there's a little less chance of fallout, perceived fallout, and what have you. But yeah, I've seen both sides where all cash wins, and sometimes a down payment will beat all cash. It just depends.
Right. Last question I'm going to ask you.
Yeah.
Sort of interesting one here. If you have, you know how we talk about home prices go up here in the Bay Area, and just like it does anywhere else, but because of the nature of the value here, it tends to go up a little higher. Is it possible that you can get into a home that's going to appreciate more than maybe a home that's worth more right now? For example, if you have a $3 million home here and then $1 million home over here, are they going to appreciate at the same rate? Or because that $3 million home is kind of on the edge of being tapped out, it might, but it's not going to go up as high as that $1 million one percentage wise, because it's kind of already at the peak of the market, whereas this one has a lot more room to grow. Is that a thing?
It's a great question. Again, it's very dependent. Oftentimes, this is what I get into in conversation with buyers who want to buy a home that maybe needs a little bit of work, and in their mind, they're going to put a bunch of money into it and make it worth a whole lot. You got to make sure you don't outbuild the neighborhood, you know, because you're not going to get that return just because you necessarily put a ton of money into the home. And there's pockets that are going to be different. You know, that $3 million home might stay at $3 million while the 1.2 is going to 1.3. Again, what's the supply and demand? How many buyers is that $3 million attractive to at this particular time in the marketplace? What's the industry in the area? Are more people more likely to only be able to afford tract homes versus this unique $3 million home up on the hill? Sometimes those luxury homes can drop when the regular average Joe mom and pop type property is going up a little bit because there's more demand for it. It all gets back to supply.
Got it.
You know, and good old fashioned economics.
So that person that buys that home for $1 million in $1 million neighborhood, but says, I'm going to dump a whole bunch of money in there. I'm going to add a second story. I'm going to make this balcony. It's going to look great with all this. And now they raise the price to $3 million because they put that much into it. Well, if you're in that neighborhood with around $1 million on the way, in one way, you can bring up the value of houses around you. But at the same time, how much is that going to go up itself? Because it's, like you said, that's it's outbuilt in the neighborhood.
Now, some people, they just have extra cash and they don't mind burning it. And they want their home to be the way they want it. They want to live where they want to live. And they know they're going to overbuild a little bit. And they might not get that return back when they sell one day, but they're fine with it. Cost of doing business to live right there in that home that they really want to be in. And they'll do that sometimes. But not often, but it does happen. But the real one that is tough is the one that overdoes their home and expects to get a certain return. That's where you got to slow down, talk with your local real estate agent that knows what the heck they're doing and say, hey, if I do this, what's my return going to be? Or which parts of the house should I focus in on? Like maybe the kitchen or other desirable places. And are you okay with overbuilding and not getting it all back? If you are, then go for it. You know, as long as your home's worth it and you got the equity, lender's going to lend on it. But if you try to go do, say, a construction loan, they're going to want to know what's that home going to be worth and only lend a percentage of it, right? But if you take equity out or have cash to burn and there's not a loan involved, you can overimprove all you want. So that's the tricky part is like on construction lending, they look at the after value cost of a home. What's it going to be worth if I have to take it back? Right?
Yeah.
And so, okay, well, then we're only going to lend this much because we know what it's going to be worth. Oh, hey, you're overbuilding. We don't know. We're not going to do that. You're only going to borrow. You're going to need to come in with $400,000 for us to lend you some money now because we only want this much exposure based on the aftermarket value of that property that we're seeing.
That's a good point. And I see it a lot here in the Bay Area. You have homes that are all kind of the same in the neighborhood. Then you get that one home somebody builds and then they gut it out and then they'll you know, dig below and add a garage and an underground. They'll add a floor. They'll make everything like, you know, like chandelier type door, whatever you want to call them, French doors that just weren't there in the neighborhood. And the house looks amazing. It's great. Like, wow, this is a lot of money in here. But then the question might be, we dumped so much money in there. Are we ever going to get that money back? So if you do it for yourself, great. But if you think, I'm going to double the value and expect to sell it, it's like, is this going to work at the end of the day?
That's right. No, it's a great question. You got to think about that.
Perfect. Well, Scott, this has been a great conversation. I learned a lot about the mortgage industry and also what things to think about when it comes time to buy a home. And then if I should buy as an investment or as a place to live in for the next 30 years. So it's been a lot of great information. Where can people get a hold of you?
You can give me a call. I give out my cell freely. It's 408-898-0100. My email is scott@hillmortgageinc.com. And my website is hillmortgageinc.com.
And you're based out of Danville?
My office is in Pleasanton.
Pleasanton.
Spent many, many years in San Jose. That drive back and forth, because I'm living in the East Bay, was brutal. Mm-hmm. I decided to move an office and start. I actually started my own business because I've been doing this 27 years. So during COVID, I started my office, a little office out of Pleasanton. But like a lot of people in my industry, it's gone digital and we're on Zoom. We're in our car, you know, driving all over the place. And so office is mobile. Quite often, you know.
Perfect. Now, are you somebody that somebody should go to first when they ask questions like this, or is this something that typically the real estate agent says, okay, now I have the buyer, let's get the mortgage officer involved?
Great question. And this is a great format to let that prospective home buyer know that they really need to talk to a loan professional first, because what's going to happen is the real estate agent's chomping at the bit to start showing property. They don't know what you even qualify for, right? So they don't want to spend too much time wasted on showing you stuff that you're not going to qualify for. And they're going to say, hey, talk to someone like Scott first. Let's get this figured out. Now plug me in and we're ready to roll. That's the best process. But it normally works out. People go to real estate agents first because what do they do on weekends? Yeah. Walking to open houses. Yep. They meet real estate agents, right? You know, or they get referred to another real estate agent. And so start if you can with a loan officer. Doesn't mean though you can't go find a real estate agent at the same time. But we also have a great network of some awesome agents that we work with that we can help you with too as well.
And then some tips for people who don't live in the Bay Area, if they're looking for a mortgage lender, what are some quick tips on how to pick out the one that's going to work for you in a market that might be saturated with mortgage lenders?
That's a great question. Remember, this is a very big deal. This is the biggest investment in your life. Don't pick up the phone calling people, what's your rate? That's like asking a doctor, what's your fee? I know you're the best at getting brain tumors out of heads. I just want you because you're the best to get a brain tumor out of your head. Ask them, how long have you been doing this? Hey, can I see your reviews? What are other people saying about you? What's your communication going to be like? What's your availability going to be like? You know, do you work in the type of loan that I might need? You know, those are the bigger questions that need to be asked. Rates are going to be very similar all the way around. It's really you're embracing a partner. When you team up with a real estate agent and a loan officer, you know, that's your team. And you need to feel good about it, okay? Because at the end of the day, it can cost you a lot of hidden money you're not aware of when you start going out into the marketplace to look at homes and you don't have the right team looking out for you. And buying a home 6 months from now can be a lot more expensive than buying a home now. So you got to think about that as well.
Hidden cost, man. Scott, it was great to have you on. Thank you so much for coming out. And I really appreciate it. And everybody, I hope you enjoyed the episode. And if you did, please share with anybody so you feel can gain some information from this. Mortgage is stuff that we don't like to talk about a lot, and most of us don't know anything about. So it's nice to find somebody who has all the answers for you and is not afraid to tell you when this may be the right thing for you or when it may not be the right thing for you. Very big when it comes to your finances. But hope you guys enjoy the episode. And if you like the episode, also subscribe to the channel and stay tuned for more episodes. Thank you, Scott, for coming on. Everybody have a good one.
Thanks for having me on your show, Mike.